This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Don Gagne, broadcasting live from the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit. This city, the Motor City, and the United Auto Workers Union are inextricably linked. The UAW's greatest leader, Walter Reuther, helped build a union envied by workers everywhere.
What we're talking about is making the labor movement into a vital force, a creative force that can begin to take the lead in the mobilization of the broad forces in America who need to be mobilized if we are to be equal to dealing with the complex problems that we face in the difficult years ahead.
But that optimism seems so long ago. The UAW once boasted more than 1.5 million members in the industry. That was in the 1970s. But for decades now, job cuts have been the story, and now the union has entered into its toughest negotiations yet. Here's UAW President, current UAW President, Ron Gettelfinger, earlier this year.
It seems that we have had to climb one hill after another. These are challenging times.
And it's an understatement to say the workers are worried about their health benefits, their pensions, their futures.
There will be some concessions. I believe this is how I see it right now. But I hope they will be reasonable. This is how I feel. And Mr. Gettelfinger will see it the same way.
This hour, from the city of the Big Three, we're going to talk about the glorious past and the uncertain future of the UAW. And later in the hour, we'll talk to Martha Reeves, a Detroit native who got us all dancing. But first, let us know, what does the union mean to you? Our number here in Detroit is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us first is Micheline Maynard. She is the Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She covers the auto industry. Welcome.
Thank you, Don, and welcome back to Michigan.
Thank you. And I'll refer to you as Mickey because you and I have spent many hours staked out at factory gates.
That's absolutely right.
Covering
factory
picket
gates,
lines and
press rooms where people used to smoke and play poker and now don't smoke and play Trivial Pursuit. So.
There it is.
And knit, actually.
There's knitting going on. Okay. The other thing we've done together many times is cover that big ceremonial handshake, kicking off a start of negotiations. Just, you know, describe that moment. What that handshake means.
Well, it is very ceremonial, and in fact, it took place 3 times in the past week at Chrysler, at General Motors, and at Ford. I was actually at Ford when the handshake took place. It's a huge table in a great big conference room, and the bargaining committees from both sides, from the company side and the union side, are looking at each other across the table. There's sort of a signal. The photographers lean in, and the CEO of the company, in this case, Bill Ford, the chairman of Ford, the CEO of Ford, Alan Mulally, shake hands with the UAW officials across the table. And there's sort of a few signals that are always sent. In fact, the union always tries to show solidarity. And this year, they showed up in beautiful blue dress shirts, sort of the color of the Ford blue, to kind of show that they were together. And Ford, on the other side, was wearing dark suits and kind of serious expressions, as they should be, I think.
And they hold that handshake for longer than anybody who's not, like, in love with the person they're holding hands with should have to hold it, right?
And in fact, Bill Ford was joking this week that, you know, if you pull really hard, you'll pull me over to your side of the table, so...
So there's this ritualistic beginning, and perhaps this year it looked like any other year, but this year is not like any other year.
You know, today Ford released its second quarter results, and they actually posted a profit and surprised Wall Street. But I was looking at the numbers that list how many people actually... Well, I guess, yeah, it is good news, absolutely. that I was looking at the numbers, and Ford listed numbers from where they were in 2005 to where they are today of the number of people that work there. There are 20,000 fewer UAW hourly represented workers and 10,000 fewer white-collar workers, salaried workers. So think about it. In just 2 years, 30,000 people no longer have jobs at Ford.
Mm. And in the intro I read, we talked about 1.5 million UAW members in the industry back in the 70s.
Right.
Today?
Right. Today it's under 600,000. In fact, there are now more retired members of the UAW than there are active members of the UAW. And the principal of the union, and I'm sure your other guests will talk about this, but one of them was that the many took care of the few, that people were in the plants and they worked and they built cars and the companies made profits so that people could have a comfortable retirement, sort of a middle-class retirement, even if you hadn't even graduated from high school or college. And now that is all under pressure as the companies and the union go into these negotiations.
When you're on this beat, when you talk to UAW officials, local presidents, I mean, one thing that they are so proud of in the union's history, and you hear it over and over, is they say they built the middle class in this country.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, it isn't just in car plants. My mother is retired from Eastern Michigan University, and I hope she's listening this afternoon. She was one of the founding members of UAW Local 1976. They went on strike in January for representation. They were administrative and secretaries, professionals at the union. They got recognized, and today she's retired with a wonderful health care plan. So thank you to the UAW for that. It doesn't affect my coverage of the union, but I'm very grateful that my mother in her retirement doesn't have to worry about things like health care.
So a lot of what is on the line in these talks is on that list of things that the union has worked so hard to achieve. Back, I mean, we heard this that piece of tape of Walter Reuther speaking so optimistically, looking up at all the things that were yet to be gained. They gained a good many of them: shorter work weeks, better working conditions, better pensions, the gold standard of health care benefits. A lot of this is on the line, right?
Unfortunately for the union members, it is. And I think they do have an out. In other words, over the last couple of years, both GM and Ford and Chrysler have offered what are called buyouts. They're really incentives to retire. In other words, if you put your 30 years in and you're hanging on to your job, please take a check for $35,000 and leave. And a number of people, tens of thousands of people, actually did that. But the people who are left are now in the situation of possibly seeing things that Mr. Gettelfinger, Mr. Stepp, other people in the union have fought for years go away. And one of the reasons that is happening is that we don't just have the Detroit auto industry anymore. We have a non-union, sort of foreign auto plant auto industry in this country now.
And those would be the Toyota plants. It would be there's Nissan, there's Subaru building cars here. Who else?
BMW and Mercedes-Benz, Hyundai, the Korean auto company as well.
So you called them non-union auto plants. The union has tried, particularly in the case of Toyota and the Nissan plant, right?
Yes.
Mightily.
Actually, they've
to
tried
organize.
At Toyota, Honda, Nissan. In fact, there was an expectation.
We didn't mention Marysville, Ohio, Honda, right?
Exactly. There was an expectation when Daimler Chrysler bought Chrysler that the UAW might be able to organize the Chrysler plant because unions have representation.
The Mercedes plant.
The Mercedes plant in Alabama, mm-hmm. because unions have representation on the Daimler Chrysler board. Now, obviously, Daimler Chrysler has sold Chrysler, and that puts Chrysler's future into some question.
Let's go to a call. Matt is calling from Syracuse, New York. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
What's your comment?
To, put a word in for the auto workers themselves. A lot of people, particularly the people that are not pro-union, they think that the auto workers are really just a bunch of overpaid complainers, when really most of these people are not getting rich, and what they're really trying to do is make a good middle-class living, which is what the union charter in the beginning represented.
Are you an auto worker yourself, Matt?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Where do you work? What kind of job do you have?
I work out in Syracuse, New York. I'm an electrician out there.
Okay. Mickey?
Well, I think that you have a very good point, and one of the things that I often say when I talk about this subject is that there are two signatures on every contract. This is not something that the UAW got because it reached out and grabbed it. It was something that General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler over the years gave them. Either they were afraid of a strike, or the union made a good case, or they felt that this was right and proper for hourly workers to have. And I don't begrudge any UAW member any of their benefits. I think the issue is shared equally by management.
Matt, how much time do you have in? How old are you, if I may ask?
I'm in my 40s. I've got about 7 years with the company. But I'm not fooling myself about any retirement benefits I might get, because those are not going to be the same as the people that have 30, 35 years with the company. But even most of the younger people that are there, you know, they're proud people and they're happy to be doing what they're doing. And some of us do take issue when we are called a bunch of overpaid, you know, complainers and whiners, because there's a lot of pride in what we do. And it's, you know, proud to be building and involved in something that's made in America.
Matt,
and people that work at Toyota, they're not doing the same thing. They don't have the same, I can't see that they have the same kind of pride.
Matt, if I could just ask you, were you eligible for any of the buyout or the incentive to leave programs?
I was involved. Yes, I am eligible for one of the. I was eligible for one of the buyout programs. I didn't take it.
Why didn't you take it?
Because I wanted to keep my job and my seniority.
Okay, but if you left, are you at New Venture Gear? What's the plant that you're at?
That's the plant, New Venture.
Yeah. If you left there, could you get an equivalent job in the Syracuse area, do you think?
I could get a job. Oh, definitely.
But would it have the kind of benefits and pay that your job has now?
Maybe not the same benefits and pay. Probably slightly less, I would imagine.
But it sounds like you're saying you didn't see quite the risk in taking the buyout, because you...
Well, I would have got a decent check of money. But I really didn't want to give up my seniority and whatever other benefits I may get down the road.
Great. All right, Matt, thanks for calling us.
Thanks, Ray.
We are talking about what used to be kind of the thriving driving engine of the Motor City, the United Auto Workers Union, still there, but in the midst of very difficult contract talks. Coming up, we'll talk about the labor movement and the struggle for civil rights and how those two things were intertwined. Mark Stepp will join us next, and we'll get to more questions from the audience and on the phone. 800-989-8255 is the number. You can also send us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Don Gagne. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Many people don't know how the history of the UAW, the United Auto Workers Union, and the civil rights struggle are intertwined. Moments before Martin Luther King Jr. spoke about his dream on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial during the March on Washington, UAW President Walter Reuther also spoke of a promise.
It is the responsibility of every American to share the impatience of the Negro Americans. And we need to join together, to march together, and to work together until we bridge the moral gap between American democracy's noble promises and its ugly practices in the field of civil rights.
We're talking with Micheline Maynard, Mickey Maynard. She's the Detroit Bureau Chief of the New York Times. And if you're in the audience here in Detroit or want to weigh in on the phone, what does the UAW mean to you? Our number here is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's go to one of the audience microphones here in the studio. Cynthia Munoz, greetings.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the auto companies and the unions afforded my family the opportunity. My father grew up very, very poor. And when he came here to work for the auto company, for GM in the 1950s, he was able to, I believe, achieve the American dream for himself and for our family. Almost all of us, six kids, have gone on to college and some higher degrees. But I don't see that opportunity existing for young people to lift themselves up anymore without the auto companies and the unions.
Where did your dad come from?
He came from San Antonio, Texas.
Okay.
And he was Mexican, and there in San Antonio, he experienced a lot of racism there for being Mexican. But he came here, and it was just his adopted city. He loved Detroit, and he never wanted to go back after that. He really adopted it as his home.
That's actually a good point to bring in our next guest, Mark Stepp. He was an employee of the Chrysler Highland Park plant for 19 years.
Right.
And in 1974, he was elected International Vice President of the UAW, and he held that position for 15 years. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you used to look out at the audience at the press conference after that handshake, kicking off the talks, and you'd see my face and you'd see Mickey's face, and here you thought you were retired, and we're haunting you again.
Many times I spent many days across the bargaining table shaking hands with Ike Hoke and other leaders of the Chrysler Corporation, as well as some of the other smaller supplier industries such as Bendix and others. I should like to take this opportunity to speak about the UAW's involvement in the civil rights movement by going back to the UAW's very beginning. You may recall that many, many years there were unions in this country, but they were craft unions, carpenters' union, plumbers' union, and so forth. And those unions were racially segregated. Black carpenters could not join the carpenters' union as such, plumbers, electricians, and so forth. Many times, as a result of that, there were black skilled tradespersons formed their own black union, black carpenters' unions, and black plumbers, and so forth.
But they were separate.
They were separate, segregated by race. 1933, when Delano Roosevelt elected to the presidency of America, legislation was passed that workers could join unions. The Wagoner Act, which was commonly referred to. John L. Lewis and Phil Murray, John L. Lewis of the Miners Union,
yeah.
Phil Murray of the Steelworkers, formed what is now known as the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations. Before, there were those craft unions, as I mentioned, but in the industry, like the auto industry, the steel industry, the electrical industry, there were those various crafts in the plant, but they were all of one employment group. John L. Lewis said, we shall organize them, but we will not separate those crafts in the plant. Everybody will belong to the same union and not separated. So they came to Detroit. And when it came to Detroit to organize auto workers in 1935, they went to black churches in Detroit. They went to the Michigan Chronicle in Detroit. Lloyd Martin at that time was the editor of the Michigan Chronicle. And they went to black leadership.
And just the Michigan Chronicle, for people listening around the country, is the large black newspaper
large
in Michigan.
Large black weekly, in Detroit and Michigan. They then asked those African-American leaders in the black community to help them to encourage black employees in Ford, in Chrysler, to join the UAW. There was great reluctance on the part of the black community to do that because they did not want to support another segregated labor organization. John L. Lewis and Phil Murray assured the black community and the black churches, black church leaders, and the Michigan Chronicle leadership in that paper that this will be different. We will not have segregated unions in the auto industry, in the steel industry. There'll be just one union. So as a result of that, they helped to organize the UAW in 1935. So the UAW started out integrated. Started out supporting fair employment, started out supporting equal opportunity for all people regardless of their identity, racially, gender-wise, and ethnically, and so forth.
Let's jump forward to when you got hired. How did you get a job?
Well, when I got hired in 1941, I was 19 years of age as a kid there, I came up from Evansville, Indiana, And like most people, a lot of people at that time were moving north to get better jobs, white and black, in the auto industry. So I got hired in the Chrysler Highland Park plant on the receiving dock, doing that uncomplimentary work, that lifting heavy.
Was it hard to get that job?
Well, it wasn't too hard because the war had started. And that helped to get blacks in the defense industry and doing that work. So I started with that. And I got it. I joined the union. As soon as I got into the hiring of the Chrysler plant, then I got drafted in the Army. I spent 3 years, and I came back in 1946. When I came back, I renewed my membership at the UAW. And then I got active in the union, doing the educational programs and so forth. And I ran for office, chief steward, shop committee, and so forth. In 1961, there was a fellow named John Conyers Sr.
We've heard of him.
Nate's dad. I was going to university.
And the father of the current congressman.
Jr. Mm-hmm. I was going to University of Detroit at that time at night. And I was pursuing a degree in accounting. I wanted to become a CPA. So John Conyers Sr. said, Mark, we're trying to encourage a lot of people in the labor movement to move up into UAW. You want guys in the UAW who are educated as well as any other discipline. So I said, well, look, I want to be like Dick Austin. I want to be a CPA. So he persuaded me to go with the route of the UAW. So in 1961, I was the first black elected to the National Negotiating Committee for the Chrysler Corporation.
We heard that tape of Walter Reuther speaking on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. He spoke earlier in the day ahead of Martin Luther King Jr. that day. What was that like for you as an African-American, at that point, young union official, very young union official still?
Well, I was inspired. I was there. And first we marched here, first in Detroit, before we went to Washington for the same march. And I worked very closely with Walter Reuther and the UAW leadership in the civil rights movement because of the position I had in the local union and on the international staff. I was hired on the staff. My time and talents were used quite a bit to work with Walter and the others in the civil rights movement.
Let me ask you, why was it important that the UAW aligned itself with the civil rights movement?
Well, the UAW is fully committed to equality, fully committed for social and economic justice for all people.
Was it popular with the white workers in the plant? Do they wonder why the union was getting involved in this kind of sidelight, maybe?
Well, it's like anything else. The majority of them were cooperative. There were those who did not like the idea of integration. This is still America, racist America. And so we had the same ill effects there as we did elsewhere. But the fact that Walter Reuther was so very strong and others, and the commitment of the trade union movement to assist all people overshadowed those who would try to deny the opportunity for anyone else.
We have another guest sitting here whom I have not yet identified, another old Detroit friend, Steve Babson. He's an author of a book about the history of working in Detroit. It's called Working Detroit, right?
Indeed it is.
It's a dog-eared book that I have right here, in fact. Yeah. you've worked with unions in this town and studied them. What's your sense of that? Was that an easy thing for the UAW to do, for Reuther to?
Well, no, and it was certainly more than just Walter Reuther, but he plays, of course, the most public and prominent role over time. But no, it was a very controversial matter when it began, but a necessary step, even from the standpoint of a realistic prospect of organizing these factories, because the employers were very skillful in playing one group off against another. And in fact, traditionally, because, as Mark mentioned, the old AFL craft unions had been whites only, and throughout the AFL, the old AFL, that was the general policy. When it suited employers, they would be, on the one hand, quite discriminatory in their hiring policies, hiring only white workers. But if those white workers went on strike, they would turn 180 degrees in the other direction and take the opportunity to enlist blacks as strike breakers. And for black workers, that was often the only way they could make find a place, and not just the auto industry, but the steel industry and downtown hotels, for example.
And now you've got two factions that are just
born to dislike each other because of those circumstances. And they're promoting this antagonism and hatred, and of course management can then use that when they choose to undermine union organization. So even those who were skeptical about the claims of racial equality could understand, among white workers, could understand that it was in their interest to broaden the alliance, not only, by the way, black and white, but remember that at this time there's also a considerable amount of ethnic anti-Catholic sentiment as well. And so the union really had to work very hard to overcome this remarkable range of stereotypical thinking and discriminatory practices that were prevalent throughout the United States. And it's really the labor movement that's making the first substantial efforts to overcome that. They're imperfect, they're uneven, there's all kinds of contradictory behavior at the local level, but still this is the institution that is making the first steps to integrate the grassroots, so to speak, of the economy.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to one of our microphones in the audience here. Tell us your name.
My name is Paula DeSanto. Okay. I'm from Livonia originally, but now in Boston.
Do you have a question, a comment?
Yeah, I have a question bringing unions kind of up to the contemporary debate. Most of what's spoken about in the news and elsewhere about the unions are them being associated with a crippling welfare state, and if you want to call it that or not, and that it's killing the American industry in this negative light. And what can and what are unions doing not only to stay relevant, but to remind us all of corporate responsibility to their workers and to their cities?
Steve, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. It's a very interesting point because particularly when you look at something like healthcare, which is one of the benefits that is frequently cited as a extraordinary cost for the big three and a competitive disadvantage. It's very interesting to me as an historian to look back at the history of how these benefits were negotiated. And the truth is that the UAW's first choice was not to negotiate health care benefits as a part of the collective bargaining agreement. Back in the 1940s, their primary goal was to win national health care and to establish basically a single-payer system modeled after what we now are familiar with respect to Medicare. And it was that proposal in the late 1940s that the UAW was pushing most aggressively. They were also organizing community-based group practice plans that focused on preventive medicine and a whole range of very progressive ideas about how medical care should be organized. And the idea was is that something modeled after Social Security and the funding mechanisms that we now link with the limited program of Medicare would be made available to fund these kinds of community-based, with community boards, not just a union board, but a community-based board that would include the union, but also other organizations, churches and whatnot, on a locally managed healthcare system that would focus on preventive care, on outpatient clinics and so on. It's a remarkably progressive moment in the history of this long-standing debate over how to provide medical benefits. And it was only the opposition of the American Medical Association, Equitable Insurance, Prudential, and the rest of them, that undermined this. Obviously, also the Red Scare and the mounting claims that any such proposal represented a kind of communist-inspired undermining of the American system that made this an impossible prospect by 1950. And it's at that point that the UAW begins to negotiate a collective bargaining response to that as a second best choice.
Mickey, we just have a little time left, but let's wrap it up with you. Something's got to give, it feels. Do we know what it's going to be?
Well, you know, I think this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, really, for the auto companies and the UAW. And I would say that the UAW has been progressive in a number of individual plants. There's a new factory down in Monroe, Michigan, I think is your hometown,
That's
correct?
My hometown.
Called GEMA, which is a venture between Chrysler, Hyundai, and Mitsubishi. And it actually has a contract the size of a pocket date book with just a couple of pages. The master UAW agreement is the size of the Manhattan phone book. So I think there's plenty of room for progressive thinking and for changes in the contract.
We're out of time on this topic today, but I want to thank each of you. Mickey Maynard is the Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Steve Babson is the author of Working Detroit and Unfinished Struggle. I haven't seen that one yet, so I'll look for it. And Mark Stepp, former Chrysler worker, former UAW International Vice President, now retired. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, Detroit is actually pretty balmy today, but back in the 1960s, in 1963, there was a heat wave. Martha Reeves will be here. I'm Don Gagne. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.